Welcome to Seeking Sanctuary House to Heart, a podcast about abuse, trauma, and finding healing in the arms of Christ. I'm one of your hosts, Hannah, from House of Faith and Freedom. You can check us out online at houseoffaithandfreedom.org, as well as on Facebook and Instagram. As always, I'm here with my co-host, Nikki.
Hey, as Hannah said, I'm Nikki, and today we have the incredible opportunity to share our space with and hear the story of an amazing survivor, Heidi. We can't thank you enough for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.
We know that, I mean, to put it mildly, it's not easy to share your story. So can you tell us a bit about why you wanted to speak up now and to share about your experiences?
Yeah, I think a big part of it is it just feels like it is time. I think there is a part of abuse, especially verbal abuse, narcissistic abuse, that really takes your voice away. One thing I learned in my story and my process, and I would say often in my own heart, was anything you say can and will be used against you. And that's how it felt in that relationship. And so to be able to take my voice back, to be able to share my story, feels like a completion of really a lot of healing and a lot of time and a lot of process that I do get to choose what I say, and that is really empowering to me. So it has just felt like it's time to be able to share it more. And I know that there are things for other people to know and to learn and to hear, and I want to offer that up. I don't want my story just to stay with me. I want it to help other people as well.
Absolutely. It's the power of testimony. I mean, one of the things Nikki and I often say is like, the truth is never the problem. And part of reclaiming a story, reclaiming a testimony, reclaiming even a trauma is speaking the truth over it. And when we talk about abuse, it's not only a voice loss, it's also that everything gets manipulated.
Yes.
I mean, there's such a loss of what is true. And I think it is through that process of healing and speaking without someone else spinning the story for you that can give some of that freedom back. So with that said, let's get into it a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about how you met your ex-husband originally, the early years of your relationship, and maybe some of the warning signs that now looking backwards, you can see were there during those dating and early marriage years that maybe weren't as obvious back then.
Yeah. Well, we met on this backpacking trip through Africa. There were four of us that backpacked 10 countries in Africa, and we spent 3 months doing it. So we just had a ton of time together. We had a ton of adventure, a lot of fun. That was kind of our process of falling in love. I had done lots of trips before in my life, and this was kind of just right out of college. Let's go do something grand. And so we started dating then. We had a few on and off moments in our dating years. He struggled with some addiction, some drug addiction, and that kind of came back up. He went to go get help for it. He sought out rehab, and then he sought out prayer counseling and some different things like that. Felt very like rid of it, healed from it, not tempted by it. And so then we got in the process of being engaged and getting married. When I look back at some of the warning signs, they're all just so evident once you look backwards and you can see like these moments that would hit me, but they were so infrequent, or they would come with an apology that felt so genuine that I just didn't take the time. And I don't think I had the skills at that time really either to think through them. One of them, I remember we were driving in the car and just kind of out of nowhere, he just said, "You know, if you ever cheat on me, I'm going to record it and play it in front of the church." And I was like, what? Like, I think these things, like when they surprise me so much and like, it's just so outside of my character or anything I would ever, like, I'm just not tempted in that way. You know, I was like, well, that's like, I'm not going to cheat on you. And that's weird, you know? And he kind of would like roll with it. Like he just roll off with it. But if I would have actually taken time to like think about, that's a pretty disturbing thing to tell someone. I think in those things, I saw this underlining like viciousness that was there. And he had a lot of jealousy. And so that came up in our dating and in our engagement time where he was very jealous of ex-boyfriends I'd had. I found out years later he sent death threats to some of them if they ever contacted me. I didn't know that at the time. He would just be really, really aggressive with people if he thought that they were checking me out or anything like that. And so, but it was all very presented in, you just mean so much to me. I just love you so much. Like it's wrong. And I'm calling them out on what's wrong. And other people are so weak because they won't actually stand up and say what's wrong. And he would kind of win people over with that. I remember him being really aggressive. We were at like this bar or restaurant and some old guy touched me or looked at me or something, just very like I was okay. And he like took him and threw him out on the street and was extremely aggressive with him, you know, and told his whole family about it or told people about it for him to be the hero. But to me, it felt gross. But I saw a lot of people around us being like, oh, way to go. Like, that was great. And so it felt confusing to me. So seeing some of those things that were just not, they didn't happen frequently. So it was confusing to really put together. Then he would do all the other nice things and all the other sweet things. And I realized looking back, I very much had this belief in those years of my own experience of I, you know, came to know the Lord and like my life just changed and I wanted to change and I wanted good and I wanted integrity and I wanted to live a good life. And so I felt like he was on that same path. So even if he did something that was wrong, he would confess, he would ask for help, he would do those things, which to me felt very reassuring that he must be changing then. Like he's just changing and I'm with him in the process of him changing. It's how it felt in those early years. And that's where I got into like hope and good things are coming and like God will redeem. And just those thoughts are actually the things that really tripped me up. I wish I would have sat with just reality. Like if I just look at reality, what does it mean?
Yeah. And you bring up sort of the roller coaster of abuse. And it's sort of that cyclical, like really, really high highs that are super romantic. And then how it will randomly take these dips into obsession, into possessiveness, into hyper jealousy, into accusations. And a lot of times as a relationship moves through that dating process and into marriage, it just gets more pronounced.
Yeah, I think there was a big switch after we got married. There was like a more justified jealousy. There was this very strong, I own you in a sense. I mean, he never used those words. I think that's always the hard thing about abuse too, is it might not be the exact words. It's just this, the feeling, the things that happen around it. And so the first 2 years of our marriage, I just described with like his rage. He just had tons of anger. And all of his anger would get pointed back to me. And he always would do these very public angry things too. If it was just like reaming me out, like in a silent whisper at a family event for what I was wearing or for someone looking at me wrong or for like this creep he doesn't want to be around and why do we have to be here? He would do a lot of these like side little things. And I just felt this like hyper anxiety around functions or events because of what he would do. At one point we were at his mom's graduation. She had gotten her master's and we were going to celebrate that. He and his sister got into a fight and he left. And I just walked into the graduation because that is what we were there for. It was his mom. And it just turned into this huge public, him screaming at me in the middle of downtown Minneapolis about, you know, what a whore I am. And because I didn't go with him, like I didn't go with my husband. I didn't side with him. I didn't chew out his sister for, you know, I didn't even know what their argument was about. So it just felt like all these things kept being amplified. His jealousy would be like he'd hear a song on the radio and think that, oh, this guy I dated in high school, he and I listened to this song. So he'd be mad at me all day because of that song. He got advice from a family member pastor that was almost as if like he had the right to be jealous, like almost as if I had had an affair on him because I had dated other people. And I don't know how much he twisted that in his own head, but he had this like belief that he had 5 years to be mad at me for some of those things. Like he really had to have time to work through it. And so I just saw many, many moments in those first years. And it was hard because I was young and married and I had a lot of young married friends, and like talking to people, everyone would be talking about like, oh, we got in this fight, like, or he's so mean, or like these things, like talking about fighting or having a hard time getting along in marriage. And I knew that there was something different in my, like, I knew his rage was at a different level. I just didn't know how to communicate that. And I didn't know how to really share with people. And I think I didn't want to share with people either. I didn't want it to be what it was. I didn't want it to be as bad as it was. I didn't want to be in a relationship like this. And so it was hard for me to let anything out about his rage and his anger and his jealousy.
Evidence of the slow fade of the voice that happens within a survivor. Did you go into a deep sense of voicelessness? And if so, like, how did you begin to talk? How did you begin to let these things out?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was just this like slow fade. I think it really wasn't until the end of our relationship that I realized how much I had lost of myself. What was interesting to me, so one thing he would do is like, if I would, I've worked at many churches. So if I would preach on a Sunday or I'd be on a stage sharing anything, he would make these comments like, you know, it was great what you said, but every guy in there is just thinking about how he wants to do you. Like, it's sad. They can't hear you. They're just looking at your body. And then it was very much like, if I would go against that, well, you're a girl. Like, girls have no idea how gross guys are. And so even in that, like that one, I never agreed with that. I never thought that was true. But yet being around someone who is constantly making you second guess yourself or make you feel uncomfortable, like it wasn't till later that I realized how uncomfortable I started to feel on stages. Because what if, like, what if this is all guys are thinking? Like, what if, like, how conscious I was of what I'm wearing? Or different things like that. Being around someone who twists and manipulates words and accusations, like there's a part of me that I always knew, but yet it had this huge effect on me. It still worked. Like it still made me change my behaviors. It still got to me in some way. That was the hard thing. So I think finding my voice has been a long process and just an awareness even of where I lost it. And where I pulled back, because a lot of the jealousy things made me interact differently with people. And it was to protect myself in some way, but it was also to protect other people. Like he would get physical with them. He would call them out of a room and ream them out in a parking lot. There was a time that it was, you know, my 65-year-old boss that he was like just raging about, where you're like, he just said hi to me. I'm his employee. Like, this is just a simple thing. But so just it made me keep backing up and keep shifting and keep appeasing, not because I believed it was true, but because the fights were exhausting. The trying to explain was exhausting. And that's the part that really does, it still has the same effect over time.
Yeah, what you just said. Yeah, even just to keep everything okay because it is so exhausting. You're willing to completely forfeit your own thoughts or perspectives. I mean, you really think about what you're willing to sacrifice just to make it, quote unquote, make it okay through the next 5 minutes or the next hour so he'll calm down or so he won't be upset or so whatever. It's amazing what can happen over time.
I think abuse often feels like there's nothing solid in the relationship to hold on to. And because they're so unpredictable, like you're always on your toes. You're always just looking for the next fire to put out, the next chaos to try to contain. Nikki and I have talked to, boy, I feel like we've talked about this a lot just in our off-air conversations. This idea of almost like a inadvertent savior complex that happens when you're a victim of abuse, because you are compassionate, because you are loving, because you do want to believe in God's ability to redeem and to help and to change. It's like, I'm willing to sacrifice all of me in order to help this person that I love and mitigate the disaster to the people around them. And so it becomes like, I'll give and give and give and give and give and give every piece of me in order to try to save this thing or to save this person. And I don't think we view it that way in the moment, but it's sort of what happens over time. And an interesting aspect of Christianity, I'm sort of going off the trail here, but an interesting aspect of Christianity, especially I think in the era all three of us grew up in, is there was this really intense belief that suffering is righteous and not a very good delineation about what kind of suffering is righteous. Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of just this like, oh, you're caught in a marriage that's really hard. Well, guess what? Marriage is hard. You know, that was the phrase I heard a ton when I was getting married. Marriage is hard. Marriage is hard. Marriage is sacrifice. Right. So you're already believing, not just like, oh, I'm hearing this from my friends. And I know mine might be a little different, but marriage is hard. I just gotta like lean in. I just gotta cling more to the vows. I just have to sacrifice more and pray more. And as I'm sacrificing, like God's gonna redeem that sacrifice. And I'm showing an example of Jesus to my spouse because I'm continuing to forgive and to be patient and to give and give and give and give and give and give. And maybe can you talk a little bit about the challenge of navigating holy sacrifice and holy suffering and also not becoming a doormat that allows yourself to be oppressed and to endure avoidable suffering?
Yeah, I think for me, a part of it too was like the belief that marriage will work if you work at it. So you just have to work at it. It's hard. But if you work at it, you will get the results you want, or you will get the relationship you're looking for. So I think a lot of what I took really from my childhood is what didn't serve me in this relationship. I think I had a lot healthier experiences more as an adult in the church, but just as a kid, just feeling like this is like divorce is not an option. You know, you never bring up divorce, like just these core beliefs, like everyone around me was married with kids. I wasn't around a lot of divorce. And it truly wasn't an option for me in those beginning years. Like it was just like, this is my bed. I have to lie in it. This is what's in front of me. So it wasn't until later on, kind of a few years into our marriage, we were at a missions trip. I was leading it. We were doing like this inner city thing. And he was just going crazy the whole week, multiple things, all this aggression towards me, all this justified freaking out. And it really came to light, which was helpful. That was like one of the moments. I hated that it was public. I hated that I'm trying to lead this thing and he's sabotaging it. That was always kind of a thing in our relationship as well, of like, if I'm leading anything in the church, that was like his realm. He didn't like that. He wanted to be the one leading. And so he would kind of sabotage the things that I was doing. And it coming to light brought us into counseling with a couple. And the couple recognized right away his abuse and recognized that, like, this is not okay. And sitting with them, I would sit with them alone. They would have time alone with him. But one of the most helpful things in that process was, like, I told them about what he'd been saying and how he'd been freaking out. And they just said, can we see those text messages? And they looked at them and they were just appalled that he would talk to me that way and like how gross and how bad it was. And so that was the first time someone said, this is grounds for divorce, and someone from the church that I respected. And so that brought a lot of freedom in that moment. I still wasn't ready to. I still really believed like we could work this out. I still really believed in him. I really believed that if we work at it, it will work. But it was the first like break in the stronger belief of like divorce is not an option. It just started to be like, you know, it might be an option. This really is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
So after we did some counseling with that couple, there was some improvement. Like he started to be less aggressive. His counselor would make him carry around a picture of me as a little girl in his wallet and say, like, if you yell at her, you're yelling at this little girl. For some reason, that helped him. So his aggression, his jealousy had all toned down. So I think that's the thing too, is toning down can feel so great because you're just not at this heightened level. So it felt better. It felt more secure. It felt like we're getting somewhere. We're having movement. Like he's getting better. So in that stage, we had our first child and then we decided to move to Arizona, found out we were pregnant with our second child. And we moved down for him to work at a church there, which was just a phenomenal church. We really enjoyed them. And at the beginning, it went well. We had a lot of friends. We had groups at our house. Like the youth group he was leading is just thriving. There were amazing kids there. And it was, I don't know, just a year and a half or so into the process that he at an event, at a youth event, he was running around barefoot. Everyone told him to put on shoes. Like there's always glass at this park. He cut his foot and wanted to go get stitches. So I brought him over to the ER to get stitches. It was just not a huge cut, we'll say. And I didn't have like a ton of compassion for him. Like he needed to put on shoes. Everyone told him to, you know, like, so we'll go get stitches. But as soon as we got to the hospital, he just reamed me out how mean I am and how just, I don't even remember all of it. I just remember walking into the hospital, just sobbing. I just went for a drive and just sobbed. Because there was a thing with him and it just felt like when he gets angry, I'd always just say like, he goes for the jugular. He's not just angry. He is trying to cut you as deep and as hard as he can. And so I came back to get him, which also like that would have been a good place for a boundary where he could have found a different ride, but I didn't know at the time. And I got him and he was just completely just kind and cheery and happy. And he had gotten a prescription for Vicodin. And looking back now, I see it so clearly. Like he did not want me in that hospital room. If I would have been in there, I would have downplayed whatever dramatic story he was telling them in order to get drugs. And so that is kind of where I think his drug addiction started or ramped back up. It had been 5 years he had been sober. And so it wasn't until 9 months later that we were back for a family get together. We were back in Minnesota from Arizona. And he just dramatically called me like, get home now. Like he's just panicking. And I came home to my parents' house and he has this huge confession to me of that he's been using drugs and he's been lying about it and he's been getting prescription. It was all prescription pain meds from either stealing from people's houses or doctor shopping. And I had like a 1-year-old and a 9-month-old. I carried the weight of our family. I just remember feeling so exhausted, just like I couldn't cry. I couldn't get mad. I couldn't, you know, I was just like exhausted. And I just felt like the rug had been pulled out from under me. Like I hated that we were a part of the church and he did this. Like it was so hard seeing ways that pastors hurt the church. And I just hated that I was in this marriage and with this person that is like hurting like these youth group kids and the church. And so I, you know, we talked about it. I said, you need to tell your boss. We've got to figure this out. Like you need rehab. You know, if you've been doing this for 9 months, his boss said the same thing. So he went to a really well-known rehab in Minnesota. And yet I just kept watching on health come up. And there was a point I was at the rehab. They do these family programs. And it was just interesting. He hated that I was at the family program. Like he hated that I was learning about codependency and learning just about addiction and lying. And so he told me he sent his roommate was in the class with me and his roommate was watching me and his roommate was going to report back the things I said. I talked to the supervisors of the event and told them They were very helpful to like keep me separate from that individual and try to make a really safe place for me. And at one of the times, and this is just where he just has rage at me for no reason, kind of throughout that whole rehab time, where I'm like, I am living out of a suitcase. I came home for a 2-week vacation, and now I'm staying in Minnesota for like 3.5 months. Like, I'm driving like 4 hours to come and visit you with the kids each way, 4 hours each way. Like, just all these things. But yet I'm, you know, the one he should be mad at. And I came out of the family program, and he was in the parking lot, and he had stolen someone's like notebook, and he was just raging about like what they were teaching us and what horrible things they were teaching us. And I panic in those moments, or I would with him, and I just know not to. It's just, I'm not even engaging, not even. And I just got in the car, and he chases the car, chucks the notebook at me. You know, just these huge, like, you know, it's the middle of the day. Everyone else is out around us, and there's just no remorse for these things. Like, so he went through the rehab and then wanted to go right back to Arizona. You know, I said, we're not ready to do that. Like, something else has to change here. So he did an outpatient, and then he just really started this process of convincing. And he's very good at this. And he will just keep nailing the same thing. The thing he wants, he will just say it over and over and over and over. And he's all nice about it. He's all nice and positive. And don't you think, like, we better get back. We won't have enough money. He had this whole plan of therapists he was going to see and psychiatrists and all the things that should have felt good. But my gut just knew it wasn't. But there was this thing of like that habit of just like wearing me down would work. And over time, it was just like, okay, I'm just so sick of this conversation. I'm so sick of this argument. I'm so sick of saying it. Like, fine, we'll try it. And so we went back, and he worked at the church for like a month, and then called for another big confession. And he had gone to a strip club, paid for a bunch of lap dances, spent all our money, like used drugs, drank, like all the things. And he lost his job in that process. So then he was done with his job. And now we have no money. You know, now it's this whole other crisis that I just have to, it's just one of those like, okay, we have to get through. And what was really helpful for me in that time was I was doing a lot of Al-Anon. And that program was just helpful to really look at my own codependency, to look at the ways that I'm appeasing, to look at the ways, like just the ways I'm not being honest. I think when you live with an abuser, you so don't want the argument that you are like, oh, it's fine, or like, no, I didn't, and just not being honest. And so that season was like this grounding in myself to speak truth. And I had a sponsor at the time, and she told me I had to call. I asked her, it was a great, great Al-Anon program there. And I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said, okay, now you'll call me every day. And I was like, what? Like, I would have never asked you if I would have known I have to call you every day. But I called her, I'd call her every day, and I dreaded it every day. But there was something so helpful. And she kept just bringing me back to, you can only look at reality. Because I'm like, you know, every little good thing that they do is like, oh, like this must be the time, or oh, they're getting better. And she just kept hammering in, we can only look at and we can only talk about what's actually happening. And it was so uncomfortable for me. And I realized how much my marriage was in the future. One day, like I hope will be, this will get figured out. And it was so painful. And I'm just naturally a positive person as well, but it's also a coping mechanism. Like it was so painful to have to sit in reality. And it was so helpful to have to call her every day, because I didn't know like how many ups and downs this roller coaster was happening, because it all just kind of meshes together. But when you look at the end of the week, like there have been 4 major issues that have happened, and I have been sobbing multiple days in the week. Like that's not normal. And so looking at reality really helped me to realize like, this is not normal. This is happening a lot. And to know, one of my main tricks in that time, not a trick, but a truth, was if I ask a direct question, and I leave confused. There is a lie. Like, he is lying. And where I needed to watch myself was, I don't need to go figure out what that lie is. I don't need to go hunt it down. I just can sit in the truth that he is lying, and that's all I need to know. And the part of like obtaining information was another thing I was working on, in that like, I'm just going to obtain information. I'm exiting this roller coaster and I'm just going to obtain information. What is real? What is happening? What is reality right now? Which helped me a lot. And it helped me not to be pulled around so easily and not be so emotionally drained all the time. Because how can you think and reason and see abuse when you are just emotionally drained and emotionally exhausted?
Let's touch on remorse and repentance real quick, because when you're talking about paying attention to reality and coming to grips with things as they are now, things as they are in the moment, and not living into this future hope. Like you said, you were living your marriage in the future. And that's such a powerful manipulation tactic that abusers use, is promises. Like, it's all these promises of change, all these promises of how it's going to be different or better or whatever. And when we look at remorse and repentance, like, this is such a hairy one for the church, because you want to believe in change. We want you, I think you said this at the beginning of our conversation, because you as a person met Christ and wanted to change and began to change, you believe that's what they're doing too.
Yeah.
And so when they cry, or when they say they're sorry, or when they call for a repentance meeting or a confession or something like that, which you've mentioned several times your husband did, them being proactive about confessing or apologizing can feel very convincing. It pulls on the hope heartstring of being like, oh my gosh, they're taking accountability. It's going to change. They're taking ownership. But there's a very large difference between ownership and manipulation that starts with tears and like spinning a story about how they're going to change. The only way to tell if something is truly repentance is with time.
Yes.
You know, when we think about the fruits of the Spirit, there's something that grows over time out of the heart, out of the change that's inside of us. And it's the same thing when we look at the fruits of sin or the fruits of abuse, is there's something that grows over time because of what's inside. And so when we think about repentance, it has to be a really, really deep internal shift, but we can't see the heart. Only God can. And so the only way for us to see is like, wait for that regrowth. What fruit is going to grow out again? And with abuse, they can do behavior modification for a short time period, but it can't sustain. And so it's like, when is that roller coaster going to dip again? And commitment to the truth is a huge part of being like, I'm going to not live in the future and assume that this change has already happened.
Yeah. I think that in my story, there was like one... his ability to like it felt so tangible. There was very much this dynamic of obsession with me and a very love hate relationship. Like, I am everything. He wants me on this pedestal, and then he wants to kick this pedestal out from under me. Like, I just want to be next to you. I just want to be a partner. I just want to be a spouse. I don't want to be either of those things. And so then there would be these grand, not even gestures, it's more in words, all this, like, it felt so tangible though. Like, I think that's the thing of like high manipulators. Like, you physically feel like you can feel anyone in the room would be like, oh my gosh, that man is so sorry. He is making a fool of himself. He's so sorry. It feels so real. And he would preach about it. He would preach about like, I'm mean to my wife and I wish I wasn't, and I need to do better. Like, he would go to a mentor and confess. He would have, you know, his seminary classmates pray with him. So then it feels like this right thing. And it really took me, it wasn't for a long time that I just knew in my gut, I didn't trust it anymore. So it's like, your words don't mean anything. Your words have lost power until it changes. But his words are what have gotten him everything. And also would have made him lose everything. But that part of like, he will always use his words to try to manipulate. And in his cycle that I've always seen is there's this deep, deep repentance. I'm so sorry. You know, let me serve you kind of part of the circle. But where it starts to get dangerous, there's this cocky attitude that like starts to come in. And just seeing like the cocky attitude start to grow. Like I'd always just know it's coming. Like he's going to do something stupid. He'll either say something stupid or he'll do something stupid. And that cockiness then gets him over to doing something really dumb. And so I think all of us, like we have to get better, especially like be leery of big emotions. And it's not across the board, but there is this part of like, discern if someone's being extra dramatic about something. Like I just pick up on that stuff so fast now. Be leery of those things and watch, like watch change happen. Watch someone go to the other side. He would never really complete counseling. Maybe he'd start counseling. He'd find an issue with the counselor. He would never follow through with the things that whatever plan we set for him to get better, it would always die off for some excuse or some reason. And so that was the part of living in reality, I think, for me, that Kate became really true. Like, yeah, so what? He apologized, but it's been 2 days and now he did this, you know, like I just wanted to grab onto that hope. I wanted to believe it would be different. I didn't want this to be my story. I didn't want this to be for my kids. Like, I wanted something different. And so I think it's really important. Like confession is great, but also like we need to notice when someone keeps saying the same thing over and over and over again. And if someone's making you put a lot of, well, what do you have to see? You know, like, what do I have to do? A lot of like really tangible things on it. Like it's really a feeling. Like, growing trust again is a feeling. It's not if you go to these 7 meetings a week and you talk to your counselor, I'll start to trust you more. It's like, no, trust needs to be growing in me that I feel that I can trust you. I don't have a tangible thing to give you that you need to do. That's on you. And he often wanted me to be his moral compass. And so if anyone's putting their decisions onto you, that is a good warning sign. In the season where he was drinking and using and we were in Arizona, I just remember feeling so empowered to say, like, your drinking makes me feel uncomfortable. I'm going to go read a book. It just felt like this, like, I get to be honest. And he wanted me to be okay with it. So he'd put a lot of pressure on, like, well, let's just have a few beers and watch a show. Come on. Like, wouldn't that be okay? That's all I'll have. Like, he wanted me to make the decision for him. And I just, that was my own health. Was me learning to just stop. I'm not going to make any moral decision for you. I'm not going to tell you what you should do. You are going to decide that. And I'm going to stay over here on my side and I will decide the things for me. But the honesty of like, your drinking makes me feel uncomfortable and I don't have to shame you. I don't have to hint. I don't have to hide beer from you. I just get to go read my book and your choices are on you. And I saw that impact him and it was very helpful.
Truth and boundaries always go together. When you can speak the truth, you can begin to set healthy boundaries. And boundaries, like, I think this gets miscommunicated and abusers will certainly try to add to that confusion of being like, you're manipulating me, right? They'll try to confuse what boundaries and manipulation are. But boundaries aren't about them. Boundaries are about what we're willing to tolerate and our commitment to the truth and to what is, and saying like, your drinking makes me uncomfortable, so I'm not going to be around you while you do it. I'm not telling you you can't drink.
Right.
I'm making a choice for myself and then I'm sticking with it. Mm-hmm. I'm following through with it. And that's uncomfortable for them because they can't stand having boundaries. Yeah. They need to know they have that sway, that control over you.
Yeah. Like he could fight with me being like, I don't think you should drink beer. You know, he could fight with that. But when it is just on you and when it's just what you're saying, this is where I'm going to meet you. This is where I'm going to be at. You choose, like, just that like releasing of him, like you choose how you are treating people and what you are doing. It felt like he didn't know what to do with it and he didn't really do anything. I think he kind of felt like, oh, I get to do what I want. But that to me was like, well, then I will see truth. Then truth will be revealed and I can make a choice from truth, but I cannot make a choice from confusion within myself. And so it was very empowering and still so many challenges. But that part just felt like I was getting my footing and getting my voice. And it just felt so good to speak truth. And it took so long to think through and process and talk with my sponsor and like, what is truth? You know, because you just want to say it all and you just want to be like, stop this. Like, what are you doing? And not that I had many moments of doing that as well, but truth is so clear and truth is so solid. And it's just something like these anchors I could just lean on and I could say repeatedly. And it was, I knew it was truth. And I was very grateful for that.
It's just overwhelming almost to hear what you're saying because it's just golden. I love this. You know, Ann Johnson, who has been on our podcast a number of times, a therapist, she compares abuse to being in a tennis court. And, you know, they're across the net, they're whacking balls, they want you to participate, and you pick up the racket in those early years and you kind of hit it back or try to reason with them, whatever that looks like to pick up the racket and hit the ball back. And really your job is not just to set the racket down. You're not even supposed to be in the tennis court at all, completely outside of it. So when you use your voice like this, I'm not telling you something new. I'm just capitalizing on what you've been saying this entire time. And that is when you're honest, truly. Yeah. And Anne also has mentioned the amazing question, as simple as it is, what do you want to say? What are you really thinking and what do you want to say? And when we can just say, you know what, I think I'm going to read a book. I do feel uncomfortable right now. So yeah, just simple, true, like you said, clear. The truth is clear. It is the most refreshing thing, I think, as a survivor, using your voice and just saying what you mean, exiting the tennis court. They're riding the roller coaster. You're not even present at the roller coaster. You know, I mean, it is a beautiful freedom.
Yeah. Mean what you say and don't say it meanly, I think is one of those quotes. It's just like, that's where power lies, or you can't argue with truth. Like it has a way of diffusing arguments. And there's a lot you want to argue with when someone's being mean to you. There's a lot you want to not allow. And so often our words have to be very thought through and very concise to say our truth. I like that. Just stay on the outside of the court.
Don't play the game. Don't even watch the game, because then you're like, oh my gosh, what you're doing is insane. Like you watch them playing the game and you're like, you're doing it wrong. You're doing crazy things, right? And you want to step in because you can see how insane it is. And they're baiting you. Like they're baiting you into the game. When we had, I think it's in Jake's story, he was a male survivor that we had on. One of the things that he talked about when he was working with a counselor in his marriage towards the tail end of it, when he was still committed to staying, but was really struggling with his wife's abusive behavior, his therapist described abuse sort of as like these hooks, like fish hooks that had, you know, fishing line. And he was like, it was like I had them hooked into me all over, all these weird little lies and connections and manipulations that would hook into me and then could be pulled on. And the process of setting boundaries was like slowly going through all these areas of my life and pulling these hooks out and being like, I'm not going to let this be something that I engage with anymore and that they can pull on whenever they want and get a reaction from me. So he talked about that being a very freeing process. So one of the complicating factors in your situation that adds to this, and actually, interestingly enough, was also something that helped you begin to deal with and work through the abuse aspect very well, was addiction and working with Al-Anon. But addiction and abuse can often be paired together, and it's a complicating factor. But I find that a lot of abusive individuals who also deal with substance use disorders will use the addiction as a justification or like an excuse for the abusive behavior, where they'll be like, it's because I was using, it's because I was high, it's because I was drunk. Like, I didn't mean those things, right? And so it gets all wrapped up in the mental illness side of addiction and feeling like how much responsibility, how much culpability do they hold when they're dealing with this mental illness? And how do I draw boundaries around myself with someone who's both being abusive and is using?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I saw a lot of it as addiction. Even the first like 2 years of our marriage, it kind of felt like this dry drunk idea. Like, he's just a dry drunk. He needs to get some more help. He hasn't really worked through some of those things. And then it went into like full-on addiction. And it can really be confusing to try to put to piece like what is addiction and what is just him. And I think that piece of like, it just became evident for me and in our story that that had always been there, was always there, regardless of his using or not, that there was this need to control. There was this need to be respected. There was this need to own me. There was all these things that were not just because of drugs. And looking at his whole story, I mean, it's just always been there. There's just been this piece, this narcissistic piece of it's all about me, and it needs to be all about me. So at the end of that time in Arizona, with him using and me just doing my own work as much as I could, and leaning into God and leaning into just everything that I was learning. One night he ended up not coming home, which he had not. That really wasn't a thing he did. So it was very strange. So it's this feeling of like, he's dead, he's arrested, like he's done something crazy, something's wrong. And he finally came home at like 5 o'clock in the morning. And I just had already had all night to process things. And I just said to him, "You just tell me what's going on. Like, what is truth?" You know, I knew I was dealing with lies. I just didn't know what all the lies were. Like, just tell me what's going on. And he just started to just go off. And I just have never, I saw him lose his mind. Like, he just went to a whole different level. His eyes, his face, his actions, like he was just out of his mind in like what that actually means. And he was confessing to doing all these drugs again and doing all this stuff. And like, you know, like we can't, like this isn't working. Like we can't just keep doing this over and over again. And he just went into just a full on rage, went into our kitchen, grabbed a giant knife out of the knife holder, was screaming at me, pointing it at me. And this very like, I'm just, you know, we're going to die. I'm going to die. Like just this very crazy state. And so he ended up going outside and he's, you know, going to kill himself in front of me. And like suicide threats happened at least 4 times before that, like significant ones. Like when he really felt like he lost control of me, there would be a suicide threat. Like, because of you, I'm just going to kill myself, to get me back in, to get me caring for him, to get me away from this issue I'm looking at that's glaring, and to get me back to being like, let me just help you. Let me just care for you. And so we were in the backyard and I just said, well, you need help. And so let's get you to the hospital. He wouldn't listen. He's just screaming with this knife. And I went inside and I just prayed and I just took a deep breath and I knew like, I will ask one more time and I will call the police. And I knew he'd be pissed at me for calling the police. I didn't want to, like, I'm not a dramatic person and I hated the level of drama that surrounded his life. So much drama. So I hated that I had to be in the drama of it too. But I went out and I asked one more time, like, you need to go to a psych hospital. Let's get in the car and go. And he refused and was still ranting. I went inside, called the police, had to wait just, you know, it felt like forever for them to come. And they came and they took him and he went to a psych ward and went on a psych hold for 72 hours. And I really felt like this has to be his bottom. Like, there is no way, you know, with addiction, a lot of people talk about people hitting their bottoms. And I'm like, this has to be it. Like, he has to be done now. He has to see clearly. And so a friend of his went to visit him. I still didn't want to see him. I didn't want to be around him after that. It was this moment too, where I just felt like this is how people die. Like this is how these intimate partner relationships, these are the moments where someone gets shot. And then the other person commits suicide. Like I just felt it all around me. I am lucky to live right now. And so I didn't want to be around him. And his friend went in to visit him. And I just thought he'd probably go from a psych ward to a rehab. And at least then we'd start the journey of healing. And the friend was like, he is just being a jerk to every person there. And he is demanding everything. And, you know, he was just about to kill himself, but now everyone has to treat him great. You know, like just these dramatic shifts of like, now he deserves everything handed to him. But yesterday he thought he should die. And so that just, it just brought so much clarity. I knew I was not willing to live with him again. And I knew he would not respect boundaries. I knew I wouldn't be able to say, you're not able to come back to the house. And he would respect that. He just blows through boundaries. And so my mom had flown down and I had to within like one, I think I found that out and maybe the next day or a day and a half later, I knew I had that 72 hours. And I just packed up everything I could and drove from Arizona back to Minnesota with a 1 and 2 year old screaming in the car. And so grateful for my mom to be with me and to help me in that moment. But then I felt very safe from the distance. It was so helpful to just have this physical distance. He's in Arizona and I'm here. So then we're back in Minnesota. He ends up flying back from Arizona to Minnesota. It felt extremely unsafe. I was really upset that someone had paid for a flight for him to come home because empathy was one of the main things he wanted. He wanted people to feel sorry for him. Like that is almost his bigger drug than all of this is not empathy, just sympathy and attention. Like that's what he really wants from people. And as he's flying home, I get a call from his counselor at the rehab saying like, I'm calling you, I'm breaking confidentiality through HIPAA because I feel like your life is at risk. Like he is going to kill you. His obsession with you is so much. And so you need to figure out something. Like he told me all the things. And he said all these things that I could feel was true. It was the first time like these things that I had not wanted to say out loud started to become true. Someone else was saying them for me. And that was really, really helpful to hear someone else say those things. And so I just had many years then, the next 2 years was just working through boundaries, communicating as little as I needed to, hoping that he would change and that he would want to change. And for a long time, I was struggling with this thought of like, okay, like I vowed in marriage that in sickness and in health, I will be with him. And if he's using, and this is sickness, then I have to stay. Like I just felt like I vowed in sickness and in health. And I kept just kind of wrestling with that because I really wanted to stick to my marriage vows. Like I really wanted that to be true. And I remember through a few different things, I don't remember all of it, but I just remember all of a sudden having the realization of I never vowed to abuse. My main thing with him that I would say repeatedly was we can work from kindness. You can be a drug addict and we can work from kindness. Like we can work on our marriage. We can work on restoration. But like there has to be a base level of kindness or we can never work on this. And realizing how impossible it was or he was letting it be that he would consistently be kind. He could be kind for a moment. He could be kind for a week. And then he would be vicious. And it was, again, the going for your jugular, vicious. And so having the realization that I never vowed, I never stood in front of God and the church and said, like, you get to treat me however you want and I will stay with you. I didn't vow to that. And that is the real issue here. Addiction is really unhealthy and not helpful at all. But like the real issue here is this abuse that keeps happening, this verbal abuse that keeps happening. And it's not anything that I promised that I would stay to. And so really right after that, I decided like, it's time to get divorced. And in my divorce, this is just acknowledging what is. Like divorce, it just felt like putting a stamp on what is, what has already happened. He's using, he's dating other people. He's freaking out on me. He's not doing the right things. I'm going to be the one to acknowledge the marriage has died. Like it's over. And so, so then we were divorced after that.
Yeah. The breaking up covenant with abandonment like that is what it is. I like what you said, that divorce was just a response to what already is and has happened. Divorce was kind of stamping the reality that already was. I feel like throughout this whole process and podcast, there's been just these pieces, these stamps of truth all over it. And I know if I'm soaking it up, I know that our listeners are soaking it up. And I'm just so thankful for that.
Join us back on the next episode when we are going to be talking with Heidi a little bit more about post-separation abuse. You've been listening to Seeking Sanctuary House to Heart with your hosts, Hannah and Nikki. For more information about intimate partner violence training for the church, check out our website at houseoffaithandfreedom.org.